you owe me. Pay me my money down. Pay me or go to jail. Pay me my money down.
Welcome to this edition of Middle Market Musings, the podcast devoted to the people and ideas of the middle market. I'm Andy Greenberg of Greenberg Variations Capital.
And I'm Charlie Gifford of New Heritage Capital. Today we're speaking with Brent Baxter, CEO of the Association for Corporate Growth. Before we start, Andy and I would like to thank our sponsor, SRS Aquium. When it comes to maximizing the efficiency of an M&A deal, no one does it better than SRS Aquium. Since 2007, SRS Aquium has been obsessed with a single purpose: to simplify the administration of M&A deals from the pitch book to the last dollar out. 50% of U.S. private equity firms and 40% of venture capital firms worldwide count on SRS Aquium to optimize how their deals get done. To learn more about how SRS Aquium is the smartest way to run a deal, head to srsaquium.com. That's srsaquium.com. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Middle Market Musings.
Brent Baxter, it is a pleasure to welcome my friend to Middle Market Musings. I want to say at the outset that when I lead off, rather than Charlie, he has the idea that it can be like a little bit of a downer energy level. So I have prepared an introduction for you appropriate the energy level and your stature. Brent Baxter, son of Pittsburgh, sage of the Mississippi Delta, major domo of the Association for Corporate Growth. Welcome to the big stage of Middle Market Musings.
Wow, thank you very much. If I still had business cards, I'd have to reprint them with that information on there. Thank you. That's very flattering.
I thought you were going to like continue on like daughter of dragons of the, you know, like a Game of Thrones Daenerys Targaryen intro. That was a lot there to unpack.
That was why I was doing it. I was doing it during the prep. Son of Western Pennsylvania. Career that we'll unpack in largely in St. Louis in finance, and then your current role as the chief executive officer of the Association for Corporate Growth, the primary M&A trade association.
It's all true. Thank you.
Well, why don't we briefly start there and then double back? You've been on the job after years as a practitioner and a board member at the local level and the national level in ACG. You are just about 90 days into your tenure running the organization. So why don't you give our listeners the 90-day State of the Union, and then we'll move on from there.
Well, good. And thank you. And thank you again for having me. I just couldn't be more like excited and energized to be in this role. Andy, I think, as you mentioned, you know, I've been very active in ACG for, you know, a couple of decades, starting at the chapter level, and then, you know, have been on the global board and served as the chair of the finance committee, then moved into the office of the chair and was chair of the board. And, you know, as an investment banker, ACG was mission critical to the success of any of the firms I was associated with. So, you know, not only active from a governance perspective, but very active as a user, very engaged, and, you know, through really no fault of the organization, we realized that we had had a, you know, pretty fair amount of turnover at the CEO level of ACG, and counting interim CEOs, we had had 6 CEOs in 7 years. And as an insider, you know, I just really felt that it was time for ACG to have someone that knew the industry, knew the practitioners, knew the members, knew the chapters. I just couldn't be happier doing what I'm doing. I'm doing it because I want to do it, because I love doing it. So first 90 days been just energizing for me. So thank you for asking.
You weren't alone in thinking that it might be good for the organization to have someone who came from the M&A profession. You know, following Tom Bond, who we both knew well, you were involved with Tom in acquiring GF Data for ACG from Graham Frazier and me. And we've had Tom on the podcast. We all, you know, recognized him as a force of nature, but someone who came from outside of the industry. Have you found it to be a transition going from being practitioner, member of the board, to being the guy who needs to herd all those cats?
Yeah, you know, I guess, one sort of fun fact to know and tell is there are 181,000 plus trade associations in the United States of America. And there is, of course, a huge profession of trade associations, CEOs and management. And most trade associations are run by trade association professionals. And there's definitely, you know, a skill set to that and a knowledge base. And as you mentioned, Tom, you know, Tom was a very accomplished change agent in the trade association world, had a track record of growing membership, offering new products and services. And in fact, in, you know, roughly 3 years, Tom had doubled the revenue of essentially our headquarter organization. But it is different, particularly, you know, ACG isn't like the Association of Optometrists, where every key member is an optometrist. You know, ACG is a much more nuanced network of private equity and investment banks and corporates and accountants and attorneys and insurance professionals and on human resources. And I think it's a much more complex, in a good way, a rich complexity. But having 20 years of experience as a member, you know, and a user and a beneficiary of ACG, I think turning that into the CEO role has just been it's something I couldn't have asked for. I'm just really thrilled to be doing it. And I think I do bring a much more immediate sense of what the value is of ACG to our different member constituencies and our sponsors. And, you know, I think the team has, maybe a different sense of direction now about where we're going to add value to our members and our sponsors and the 150,000 people that attend our events every year.
Brent, we'll spend a lot of time talking about ACG and why you decided to take the job and your objectives as you sit in the seat of CEO. But before we do that, it'd be great to share a little bit more, if you could, about your background. Where did you grow up? Where did you went to college? And any creative stories along the way?
Sure. So grew up in a town called McKeesport, Pennsylvania, which is was a mill town back in WW2. My dad was a professor at University of Pittsburgh. And in the 1950s, he was hired by the Gulf Oil Corporation to help them understand whether electronics would have any impact on business. So there's a picture of my dad in the 1950s on the cover of Iron Age magazine, leaning on a UNIVAC card sorter computer thing. So that gives you some sense of the radical nature that information technology has had on our society.
Yeah. Do you keep that picture framed and mounted somewhere?
I do, actually. It's right here somewhere.
Yeah. I wouldn't let that kind of keepsake get very far.
Yeah.
That's
yep. Yep. It's within walking distance. Yep. So, and then of course that field outgrew my dad pretty rapidly and spent the rest of his life Gulf Oil and human resources. But you know, McKeesport was a town in absolute transition. The steel mill jobs had begun to leave by the time I got to high school. It was a pretty tough high school. A lot of violence. A lot of learning how to talk your way talk your way out of getting extorted from your lunch money. So maybe I got some people skills with that. But went to Allegheny College, a small liberal arts college in Western Pennsylvania. Went there because it was family legacy. My mother was the valedictorian of the class in 1939 at Allegheny College. And I was obviously one of the first women back in those days to have a liberal arts education. I sort of studied really liberal arts at Allegheny and was taking a lot of philosophy, religion, thought I might want to be a teacher at the college level. And
what changed in you that caused you not to chase that dream?
Well, that's a great question, Charlie. So my freshman year, while I was sort of deciding what I wanted to do when grow up, I got a job as a busboy at a relatively fancy Italian restaurant in Meadville, of all places. I was relatively close to a professor in the religion department at Allegheny who had taken a job there. He was PhD. It was a non-tenure track position, so he had no possibility of a longer career there. And somehow I discovered that I was making more money as a busboy than he was as a professor at a liberal arts college in the humanities. And that sort of was a moment of career reflection and said, you know, maybe I ought to do something where I can make a little bit more money. And oh, by the way, I enjoyed it. And then I became a waiter and I was making way more money. And that sort of put my trajectory for the rest of my life into some form of business activity.
What is the one, if you met a young person tomorrow who is going to be a wait person, what is the one piece of advice you would give them for success?
Well, you know, waitering is actually a wonderful, wonderful early stage and frankly, career in my view. It's not a service job, it is, but you know, your job is to entertain and delight and understand why your customers are there for what experience. And it's a sales job, you know, you're upselling all the time and you're basically a commission person. And it's fast paced, it's very energizing. So I learned a ton as a waiter and later moved into management in the restaurant business. And, you know, it's working with people and sometimes working with drunk people. And you really learn a lot of people skills and people management and multitasking, frankly.
I've often heard people say that every person should spend time as a waiter or waitress. And of course, I think that's a great idea, of which I never employed with my own children. But I do think there's something to be said about thinking, you know, being on your feet, making people happy, listening and delivering. It's got to be really, really good experience.
Yeah, you know, and back in those days, you know, I could actually like remember the order, you know, for a table of eight people, their appetizers, their salads, their entrees, what drink they had. And of course, they all thought that was pretty cool. But it's also a job that keeps you mentally acute and tremendous social skill development. There's no doubt about it.
So when you graduated from Allegheny, you stayed in operating the restaurant? Is that what you said?
Yeah, within 90 days of graduating from college, I was offered the position of managing that restaurant. And, you know, fortunately, you know, I went through the whole sort of rotation. So I learned everything that was going on in the kitchen, became a line cook, broiler cook. So I could basically pinch it anywhere in the restaurant. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. The hours suck.
Yeah.
And the lifestyle is pretty awful. My wife had a day job and, you know, we seldom saw each other. And, you know, at some point it became very clear that that was not where I wanted to spend the rest of my life, working when other people don't.
Before we move on to what's next, favorite traditional Italian dish? Go.
Lasagna.
Lasagna. And I guess we have to ask Andy. Andy, what's your answer?
Linguine with clam sauce.
Oh my God. That's exact. So vongole. Yeah, me too. God, that's the only thing we have in common. Yeah, that's amazing.
So Charlie, you were going to go for the, what did you call it? Vongole.
Yeah. Clams in Italian. I'm amphibious. I can talk different languages. That's what vongole means.
I was playing dumb.
You are. Where are you though?
It's the opportunities are so rare in this podcast. So Brett, before
I will say I learned how to make all that stuff. Veal saltimbocca and the scallopinis and the clams and fried. I peeled a lot of calamari. From raw little calamari, sliced it up. And so it was a great experience.
Love it.
We know one another pretty well. And I said to you, you know, before the conversation, that I think of you as somebody who has a great natural centering metabolism for deal work and business. And I'm just curious how much of that came to you naturally and how much of it was developed through early experiences, like working in the restaurant.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a wonderful compliment. I'm not sure I can dissect nature versus nurture here. I was the youngest of three children, and my oldest brother ended up being severely bipolar. And, you know, that really impacted our family. I was 10 years younger than Bruce. But I think that, you know, as an 8-year-old, seeing a family go through that, you know, kind of develop some maturity. I was often the peacemaker or the, tried to be a stable, kid. We were talking earlier and I said, it could just be because the accident of my birth, I'm a Libra and, maybe that helps with balance and so forth. But, Andy, I think, any career is a sum of its parts, and starting off in the restaurant business, learning people skills, and then just being fortunate to find that I'd liked business and sort of had an intuitive sense for balance sheets and P&Ls and how to, motivate people. It's all just sort of been a happy trajectory for me.
No, that's great. A lot of people in situations like that, they shut up like a Vongole. So
I actually think it's pronounced Vongole, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I can't pronounce Musigs either.
So. No, you can't. Nor Macomb. But anyway. So Brent, you the Western PA guy, ended up in St. Louis. What was the path you took to end up in St. Louis?
Well, it's sort of an odd twist of fate. Leaving the restaurant industry, went to work for a privately held company that in the Pittsburgh area. That predominant business was wholesale grocery distribution to independent grocery stores. But the owner of that business, the family owner, really had a passion and wanted to be in the restaurant business. And my family knew his family, and he knew I was running this fancy restaurant up in Meadville. So he brought me on board to help lead them into the restaurant business. That didn't work out through a whole set of circumstances, but I did end up getting P&L responsibility for 6 or 8 subsidiary businesses of this relatively small family holding company. What ultimately got me to St. Louis, the core business of that company was wholesale grocery to independent retailers. That business had been in decline beginning back in those days, but the third generation of that family came on board. They did a rapid expansion, bought a bunch of stores, tried to convert them to independent retailers. They blew up the balance sheet and the company went into Chapter 11. And the second largest secured creditor was a bigger wholesale grocery company in St. Louis called Wetterau. Wetterau acquired the proxy rights to the business and came in, and I was the shiny penny. I was running a $50 million book of business that was profitable, and the rest of the company was kind of catastrophically bad. And they sent a part-time guy in to help run the company through bankruptcy, and he appointed me as sort of the chief admin officer, if you will, and I was really the point guy in my late 20s to run a $150 million revenue company through a bankruptcy reorganization. And at the same time, I was fortunate enough to be in the executive MBA program at the University of Pittsburgh. So at age 30 or 31, I kind of got 2 degrees, my MBA from an academic institution and my hard knocks of taking a company apart and putting it back together through the Chapter 11 process, which was an amazing learning experience. And coming out of that, I was offered a position with the acquiring company, Wetterau St. Louis, in the mid-1980s.
Detour from your business career, very important question. Did you migrate from being a Pirates fan to a Cardinals fan? And if so, when did that happen?
Well, you couldn't have plated that up better. So when we lived in Pittsburgh, we didn't have kids, so on a Tuesday night, we'd decide to go to a Pirate game. We'd drive downtown. We'd buy general admission tickets for about $5 each. We'd walk into the stadium and we'd give the usher $5 and we would sit 3 rows away from wherever we wanted to sit because there were only 2,000 fans in the stadium. Then we moved to St. Louis in the mid-1980s and I bought me my general admission tickets for $5 and I walked, with my bride into the stadium with my $5 bill. And the usher said, "We don't do that here, sir." And we sat in the general admission seats with 38,000 of our fellow Cardinals fans, and the Cardinal baseball experience is entirely different than, and you hear it, the Cardinal fans, it's really a unique experience. So it was pretty easy to migrate from being a Pirate fan to a Cardinal fan.
But you were in Pittsburgh in 79 during the Kent DeCult, Willie Stargell, Dave Parker heyday when they beat the O's.
We are family.
For sure. Sister Sledge. You were there for that, right?
Yes. Yeah. And they had trouble selling out the World Series in Pittsburgh.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I hated that team. I mean, you know, growing up when Brenton and I did it, the Phillies and the Pirates, the Charlie.
Thank you.
Not so much before your team, but one or the other won the division every year. And intense rivalry. But that We Are Family Pirates team.
One of my restaurant experiences, so we were, pretty well-respected Italian restaurant. I had this little tiny office, maybe 10 by 10, but we had Tommy Lasorda and Chuck Tanner were together for dinner, and they went into my office to talk baseball. And it was really pretty fascinating.
Did you get to eavesdrop or not?
I did. Yep. They just sat right there, and it was all about, how much you get for how much you pay, and it was more of a business conversation that clearly related to the talent that they were discussing, but kind of two legends. So it was pretty exciting.
Tommy Lasorda grew up right around here in Norristown, Pennsylvania, and I think knew his way around an Italian restaurant as well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Yeah. He later became like a Weight Watchers advertisement or something, but those two guys were both able to eat heartily, I'd say.
All right. So, getting back to early Brent Baxter career, from this operational experience, you transitioned into investment banking. Tell us about that.
So when I moved to St. Louis with Wetter Owl, they were predominantly a grocery wholesaler, retailer. But in somewhat an accident of fate, they had a frozen bakery manufacturing business. And back in that time, the ability to freeze yeast was kind of revolutionary. And it was that technology that really enabled the supermarket industry to go into in-store bakery. So frozen dough, same French bread across every A&P store or Safeway store. And so I ended up being the president and CEO of that business unit. And it grew in a period of 5 or 7 years from $60 million in revenue to $250 million in revenue. As the supermarket industry was headlong going into in-store bakery during that period of time, 35,000 supermarkets put in bakeries and 35,000 independent bakers went out of business. But that was a tremendous high growth, high margin, high cash flow business. But the other part of the company, sort of deja vu all over again, the wholesale grocery side of that parent company, which is called Wetter Owl, was a declining business because of the ascendance of the chains, Kroger and then ultimately Walmart. So in a transaction somewhere in the early 90s, Wetter Owl was acquired by another wholesale grocer called SuperValue, and they made it very clear that they were going to hold the bakery asset for 5 years for tax reasons. They sold it to Pillsbury, and at that time it was very clear that I was not going to be part of the Pillsbury management team. And I was in my early 40s and wanted to do something more entrepreneurial, which is the segue to investment banking. I started to look for a business to buy, hired a buy side, basically business broker slash investment banking firm to do a search. Started doing consulting work for a company that was then called All Bon Pan, now known as Panera. They had some frozen bakery assets. That ultimately I represented them in selling. So I sold a frozen bakery manufacturing operation from All Bon Pan. And then I was in the investment banking business, found out I really liked it, liked the transaction. As you know, it's complex, many, many moving parts. Joined a small firm in St. Louis and then subsequently left and formed a different firm. Was there for 18 years and then moved my practice to Nolan, which is where I was before taking on the ACG role. So 25 years as an investment banker.
Charlie, did you know au bon pain? It means some good bread in French. Yes.
You know, when people listen to this podcast, you just never know what sort of kernels of knowledge they're going to be, they're going to glean. It's really exciting.
I think Rosetta Stone is hearing footsteps.
Wow.
We're covering the Renaissance languages. You're listening to Middle Market Musings, brought to you by Greenberg Variations Capital and New Heritage Capital, along with our sponsor, SRS Aquium.
So, Brent, your past includes time, operating a business, working on the buy side, working as a consultant, working on the sell side as an investment banker. And now you find yourselves pivoting to this new role over the last couple of months as CEO of ACG. Maybe we can start by, for those that don't know, and I imagine they are in the minority, but in your words, maybe you can share with our listeners, what is ACG?
Well, it's a probably bigger question or longer answer, but it is sort of the leading merger and acquisition trade association, membership-driven trade association in the world. We have just shy of 14,500 members. It's a chapter-based organization, so there are ACG chapters in every major city in the United States, Canada, and a lot of the European capitals. And it's really a mosaic of the full M&A deal-making world. We have a large constituency of private equity, family offices, independent sponsors, large constituency of investment banks. But we also have the whole world of M&A advisory community from attorneys, accountants, and wealth advisors. But it's all, you know, fundamentally driven around the middle market M&A process and ecosystem. Middle market being defined as, you know, deal sizes, 10 million to a billion. It's just a terrifically sticky organization.
There are lots of thousands and thousands of trade associations in the country. I would imagine most of the members do something similar. But yet with ACG, you've got lots of different practitioners that are members come to the association from all different walks of life. How does that make your role as CEO more challenging?
So first, a great observation. I have since learned 181,000 trade associations in the United States, and most of them are singular. They are all optometrists, or they're all veterinarians, or they're all whatever. And ACG is more organized around this industry, this purpose. And to some extent, you know, I think, Charlie, being an insider in this role will really prove invaluable to our members and our chapters and our staff, because it's a complex mosaic. And, you know, I talk about my journey as an investment banker. I would say, and I'll say this, you know, it's sort of by illustration, you know, helping folks understand the complexity, but also the sort of common purpose. You know, 70% of the clients my firms secured somehow had a connection to ACG. And that was most often a referral from an accounting firm, a lawyer, a commercial banker, a wealth advisor who was part of an ACG chapter somewhere, who I got to know, who our firm got to know. So deal origination for the investment banking community is deeply rooted in that ACG series and set of members. But then every transaction, how did we go find our buyers and sellers? Well, ACG membership databases were part of that research. Meeting the private equity community was part of that initiative. But then every transaction, both sides had numerous ACG members, whether it was the law firms, the accounting firms, the Q of E providers, the financing sources. So it really brings together this pretty vast community. We have a large number of corporate members inside of ACG as well, who are looking to better understand the practice of M&A and understand how to get middle market deals done. I really feel, you know, blessed to bring this sort of insider perspective to the leadership of ACG, where I really kind of understand why our members want to meet each other and who they want to meet, how long they want to meet, where they want to meet, and what the value proposition is for our sponsors and so forth. I'm bringing 20 years of pretty granular knowledge to the role.
You're talking about the network effect that makes ACG different from, for example, the Ophthalmologist Trade Association, where, you know, most ophthalmologists, I think, aren't there. They're there to catch up on advances. They're not there particularly to meet other ophthalmologists. So much of ACG has been the networking that you're describing. And that has evolved a lot over the past 10 or 20 years, in part because of the success of ACG, technology, CRM systems, and other devices. How do you assess where, as part of the value proposition, as you said, how do you assess where ACG is in offering that networking to its members versus other expectations that the membership now has today?
Good question. And, you know, I think where ACG is today is we are by far and away the best networking organization in this industry, and maybe among the better networking organizations in the trade world. But we have an enormous white space to go to make that whole process more efficient. So, you know, as an example, you know, ACG, as all these listeners would know, you know, has a whole series of deal events. They're called Capital Connections or Deal Sources or Business Connection events. Our largest event is DealMax. And at DealMax, we schedule 13,000 one-on-one meetings during the 3 days that that community is there. But as the ACG grew up with this chapter model, we ended up having 20, 25 different scheduling systems. So private equity or investment banker users that traveled around multiple events had to learn 13, 14, 15 different scheduling protocols. Several years ago, ACG launched a platform called ACG Access. It's now being used by roughly 20 of our chapters. We're now scheduling 50,000 meetings a year through that tool. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be announcing a pretty major investment in that tool to make those meetings more curated, a little more bespoke, a little more relevant. And I believe it's sort of going to be a game changer for that tool. But where we are today is after that technology announcement is made, we're going to understand much better why and what those folks are meeting about. So let me just use an example. We schedule 60, 70,000 meetings a year, and we can learn that 5,000 of those meetings were related to pet care or pet products. Well, now we're able to build user groups inside of ACG, industry vertical information inside of ACG. So once we're, and that's going to take a year or two to get to the level of technology we want, but that will, you know, it's like networking cubed, much, much more relevant connectivity among our members, and I'm very excited about that.
It also jibes with something that we've talked about a number of times in recent months, the evolution away from the far-flung auction in many cases, both among sell-side advisors and the buy-side community. There's a feeling that, yes, there's some businesses that are still suited to 100, 200, 300 books going out, yep. But more what people are looking for is that kind of targeted experience. So, you know, our friend Ted Kramer from HKW was on the podcast a few months ago. We were talking with him about the fact that, you know, not so many years ago, the way sell-side investment bankers showed that a firm like HKW was on their screen was they showed them everything. Right. Now, rather than doing that, they get a call saying, we don't see the angle here, but if there's something that we're missing, tell us. And so everyone gets to operate with more precision. And it's, I think, you know, well fed by the kind of refinements that you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that there's a migration to industry specialization. You know, you can't be all things to everybody. And that's part of the power of the headquarter operation of One ACG. You can't build an industry vertical data connectivity system chapter by chapter by chapter by chapter. You have to do it across the whole membership database. And, you know, I'll connect the dots here, Andy, too, to the GF Data acquisition. Thank you very much. You know, GF Data slices and dices, you know, by NAICS code, and they do a very, very granular, you know, analytic about, you know, valuation and leverage, you know, in industry by, you know, incredible detail by industry. Well, now, if we can connect the dots between, you know, 5,000 of our 70,000 meetings were in pet care, and oh, by the way, here's the valuation metrics inside of pet care. Now we've created this cohesive information system that's really, really valuable to all of our members and helps everybody make better connections in the areas where they want to do deals, whether it's pet care or technology-enabled services.
Brent, maybe you could share with us the thought process when you were first identified as a candidate to become CEO of ACG. Were you immediately 100% in? Were you a little skeptical? What was that like?
Great question. So when Tom Bond left, we fairly shortly thereafter, Tom to us through a search process with Korn Ferry. And search had only been done 3 years prior to Tom moving on to the private sector. So Korn Ferry was engaged and had started the search process. I really did not think at that time about sort of putting my hat in the ring. It was really only at DealMax this year. So the search process had been going on for a couple few months. And it was really at DealMax, I recognized sort of at a visceral level that we really had had some change, some lack of continuity in the C-suite of ACG. No fault of anybody, but between interims and CEOs, we'd had 6 or 7 CEOs in 7 years, and that was pretty traumatic for the leadership. You know, it just sort of felt to me as I was engaged in DealMax that, you know, it just felt right to me, to consider becoming the CEO. As I think, your listeners would be aware, I've been very active on the board, I've been chair of the board, and, so I really understood, the headquarters functions and had been instrumental as part of the many teams that worked on our strategy initiatives, been very active in the GF Data acquisition, so I had a, pretty detailed understanding. So I actually put my hat in the ring, Charlie, in sort of the middle of the Korn Ferry process. Credit to the board, the Korn Ferry process unrolled. There were, it didn't stop with Brent. Other candidates had been pretty far along, and there were some really exceptional alternatives to Brent. I will say that those alternatives, by and large, were other folks with trade association credentials, as opposed to sort of the insider. So I went through a full vetting process with Korn Ferry, full vetting process with our search committee. The board of directors interviewed several candidates, and I was selected out of that.
It's one of the interesting perspectives that I get out of doing what we do is that sometimes how you act on what you think depends on the chair that you're in. Where I'm on the board of directors of a company, it's different from being a vendor, a sell-side advisor. I mean, even if you're a trusted advisor, it's just a different kind of weight behind what you say that needs to be marshaled differently. Have you found that kind of shift in valence going from being a member of the board, even chairman of the board, to being the chief executive officer?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll say it this way. I really enjoyed that first 20 years of my career, where I was responsible for running businesses. And I also enjoyed my investment banking life. I always told people, I don't have a job. I just really enjoy what I do. I got a lot of energy out of that advisory process. But the one thing that I just did not like about investment banking is it was so transactional. You go through this intense process with a family-owned business, you get these deep relationships with the owners, you go through a very complex process, highly emotional, you get a deal done, and it's done. So you don't really have any ability to really see longitudinal improvement. Even as a board member, you're more advisory. And I've also been blessed to sit on a decent number of family advisory boards and nonprofit boards. And I got a lot of energy out of that because those were more longitudinal. You can see change over a period of time. But I had an itch that needed scratched about really being engaged with an organization to make long-term change and improvement. And I just am, energized by this ability to take this really fantastic organization and see if we can harvest some of its great potential. ACG has been flat in membership for 10, 15 years. While the middle market has doubled or tripled, so there's a lot of white space for us to go after. And there's a lot of areas where we can add value to our members and our potential members. And I'm real excited about that.
So let's go there if you can. So when you poll ACG members asking of their needs as it relates to ACG, what do you hear? And how are those responses perhaps surprising to you?
Yeah, this is a little bit of true conditions, but You know, ACG has never, in a sort of disciplined way, really tried to understand the membership value proposition from a headquarters perspective. And it's different for our different member constituencies. So, you know, the reason that a regional bank in Kansas City is active in ACG is very different than a private equity firm in Los Angeles. The reason a regional accounting firm in Orlando is engaged in ACG is very different. The reason a mid-market boutique investment banking firm, so we have a lot of different value propositions. You know, I think I bring some head start to that, you know, in terms of my user experience of over 25 years of helping, you know, of understanding why I'm connecting with these different constituencies. But we have a lot of work to do there. You know, we know some of the stuff that's intuitively obvious. You know, clearly ACG is doing a, you know, pretty mission critical role in deal origination for private equity and deal connectivity between private equity and investment banks. But, you know, one of our largest member categories is commercial banks, regional banks. And as we all know, you know, less than 10% of private equity financing is, you know, occurring to that commercial banking community. So there's a different reason that those folks are involved in ACG than trying to find, you know, private equity deals to finance. They're connecting to these middle market companies all through our chapter system, and they're financing private businesses, and they're building relationships with accounting firms and attorneys and investment banks for referrals. And oh, guess what? They're among our biggest sponsors in those Midwestern cities and smaller chapters. So we got a lot to learn, and that's part of the initiatives we're launching, is a much deeper understanding of this, the sort of value proposition by member sector.
DealMax 2024 will be back in Las Vegas, become a favorite spot for everyone. Being held when in the spring?
In April.
So what would you like?
The dates off the top of my head, but I don't.
I just got an email saying if I don't book my hotel room now, I'm going to be cut out of the Aria. So I did make my hotel room already.
Just make sure that you made it through the membership, because there are so many scams that are going on with this hotel.
Yeah, process. I send you one of them.
Yep. Yep. Including one that says if you don't book your room now, you're toast. And so make sure you booked it through your reg.
By the way, that would be so me to have booked it, and I'm going to be like 3 miles from the. Yeah. You're gonna... Oh, boy.
So, Brent, as you may or may not recall, at DealSource last year, ACG was nice enough to let Charlie and me broadcast. Do our podcast live from the floor. And I don't want to say it was like the Beatles being on Ed Sullivan, but it was a pretty dynamic event.
Did you have to write like a large sponsorship check to get that placement?
No.
I'm still learning on my job here.
We might have taken advantage of the interregnum.
it was mostly charm, I think, right?
Hey, Charlie, did you get that interregnum? That's some Latin for you, man.
Yeah, we've got Latin. We've got France. We've been to Italy, and we've been to France. This is just a worldwide tour.
Brett, what I was going to ask you is, of these very, you know, value proposition, understanding what is properly done at the national level, one ACG rather than the chapters. But looking ahead to next April, 6 months from now, if there was one thing that you would like to be able to say with more clarity in 6 months than you could say now, what would it be?
It's sort of a bifurcated answer. I mean, DealMax is not for all of our members. You know, it's clearly heavily populated by private equity, independent sponsors, and investment banks, a little bit of family office. You know, we're working very, very hard to build the strategic acquirer piece there. And we really have a concerted effort to get what I'll call the private equity operating partners or the private equity C-suite back to DealMax. So we're working with our sponsors on some real content heavy kind of programming that is about the sausage of creating value for portfolio companies, about how to integrate, acquisitions, how to integrate CRMs, how to do HR integrations, how to use AI in deal origination. So, we're trying to up the what I'll call the relevant education piece for the folks that haven't been coming to DealMax, which is what I'll call the operating side and the corporate side. The corporate side wants to come for content. They want to learn stuff. And of course, that's a natural for our sponsors because they're the folks that own all that content and that mid-market expertise. So what would I like to see DealMax this year? We've had record numbers 2 years in a row of private equity and investment bank, and we're going to set another record this year in terms of those attendees. I've already mentioned our investment in a more curated deal scheduling tool that'll help make those meetings more relevant. But we'd love to see, last year we had about 120 strategic acquirers there. We hope to get that number up into the 200s. We want to create some connectivity between the corporate attendees and the private equity attendees. And we want to have really rich content that appeals to the corporate education market and to the inner side of the operating side of the private equity firm.
Yeah, unsolicited, but I thought DealMax was spectacular last year. You know, the year before was kind of the first post-COVID year. Of course, we just done the GF Data deal, so that had some momentum, but it really felt like last year's event was, you know, just well on its way to being something that the organization hadn't been before. So cycling back to food, curious, Brent, we'll start with you, culinary background. The go-to meal you would make if you were going to be away from your family for a while. So it's food, Charlie, but you have to prepare it.
Well, that's tricky because now you're talking about something that I can make that they can enjoy like multiple times, right? So you can't just like make a little chicken piccata, you know. So I'm going to have to go with like a big lasagna, you know, that serves multiple meals and freezes well.
And what's is this a meat lasagna?
Sure.
Yeah, wait, absolutely. A little sausage, ground beef.
Yeah, can. Yeah. Might put some veal in there. Depends on your audience.
I make this killer Caesar salad where I make crispy bacon, like a little extra crispy. And then I take like sourdough bread and then I put it in the bacon fat. And then I put it over, you know, shaved Parmesan and romaine, extra lemon in the dressing. Makes a really light, fat-free Caesar salad with just very salt and pepper on a lovely filet grilled outside, drinking a Montrachet or something like that.
That was really fully realized.
Yeah. Well, I think about that stuff.
All right. I was going to say marinated chicken thighs and baby back ribs made in the smoker. That would be
your go-to.
Yeah. Well, my sons are very pro meat. So they would appreciate that.
But Brent, listen, you've been a great sport spending time with the great unwashed that is middle market
things. No, it's been delightful.
In good news and bad news, the good news is you made it to the end. The bad news is I did just check to see where my hotel confirmation was for DealMax. So my question to you is, I'm imagining as CEO, you must have a lovely room, and I wanted to know if you wanted to share it because I'd rather stay with you than Andy. And you don't have to respond now on the air. You could probably give it some thought and just get back to me. But anyway.
Yeah. My people will get back to your people.
The people that know me know that I'd rather walk to Las Vegas than your hotel.
I think we've just discovered the answer to the question. What could cause Brent Baxter to rethink his open door policy as CEO?
Touché.
Well, Brent, yeah, as expected, just a delight to have you.
Oh, thank you.
And grateful for your time today. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very
much. We'll look forward to seeing you soon.
Excellent. Thank you both. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Middle Market Musings. We'd like to extend our sincere thanks to Brent Baxter for joining us today, as well as our sponsors, Greenberg Variations Capital, New Heritage Capital, and SRS Aquion. Thanks as well to our editor, Jason Zappalo. If you enjoyed today's podcast, we'd encourage you to like and follow Middle Market Musings on Spotify, Apple, or whichever provider you use to access podcasts. And of course, feel free to share with your friends. Thanks again, and we look forward to catching you on the next one.